This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Cynthia, and I'm the guiding teacher for a sangha that is having a sesshin here this weekend. Our sangha is called Great Spirit Sangha, and we mostly live in San Francisco, but we have a little splattering of Modesto and Portland, Oregon. And we are largely practitioners who practice out of our home temples. And I want to thank Jikoji yet again for your generosity in terms of letting us come here and avail ourselves of your beautiful setting and this beautiful Zendo. If I were not an evolved Buddhist, I would be very attached to it, but it's okay. And I do want to offer a quick apology to anyone who was expecting a talk about the series that's been given here. It sounds quite wonderful, and I'm sure it would have been a absolutely terrific talk. I'm particularly saddened because today I would really love to hear an absolutely terrific talk, but so it goes. But I think, Nico, will be next Sunday. Will it continue the series? Okay, so please come back. We have been having a practice period. Let me just ask a quick question to get the temperature, if you will, of the Jikoji Sangha, if you will. How many of you have been practicing for like under 3 years? Are new to practice? Okay, quite a few of you. All right. So we have been in a practice period. We're concluding it. It's been a particularly kind of a special practice period because we have had a Shuso, a head student. And but the theme that we selected for our practice period is one that's actually very dear to my heart, which is everyday practice. And it's kind of works for me on two different levels. One, because I am not a monastic practitioner. I have a job. I live in a house in San Francisco. I have family, and all of these places are my practice center. But also because it just really speaks to the fact that practice is absolutely every day, everywhere. And we have been looking at how, by using ritual and using creativity, we can bring our attention and focus to all the moments of our lives, to remember to practice them, to learn how to practice them a little bit differently. We've been looking at relationships and places like work to inquire and to, you know, how can we bring this practice forward wholeheartedly. For those of us who do not live in a practice center such as this, or mountains and rivers in New York, or Tassajara, or someplace like that, our practice environment is much more diffuse. And there are many, many distractions, and there's not necessarily that same rigid or strong, not rigid, strong structure internally to help us reinforce our practice and our own individual training. So this seemed like a very good topic for us. On Friday night, I was giving a talk to the Sangha here and kind of coalescing, if you will, what I feel everyday practice is really all about, which it is that, you know, whatever your setting, wherever your life brings you, however you embody your life as a lay person, a worker, a monastic, a non-monastic, that for me, the spirit of everyday practice is just to be able to be with your life, with yourself, under all circumstances, to be radically present, to be completely connected as best we can in any given moment with all the moments of our lives. We tend to live our lives, no matter what setting we are in, by doing lots of picking and choosing. I like this, I don't like that. This feels like practice, this doesn't feel like practice. Oh, I'm here at Jikoji with all these people with rakusus and robes and incense and bells. That's practice. being in the express checkout lane at Safeway, no, that's not so much traffic practice. But for me, and I think in the spirit of Buddhism, that the real sentiment is that absolutely everywhere we put our foot, wherever we find ourselves, is an opportunity for practice. A seemingly simple concept, and yet kind of like Zazen, radically hard. Just sit down, right? So I am interested, and I think kind of the heart and the meat, if you will, of practice is kind of exploring and learning and training ourselves to figure out how we do that. How do we cultivate this radical presence in our lives every moment? How do we train ourselves to not discard big pieces of our lives? Perhaps you have noticed that you've driven across town and you remember getting in your car and you remember getting out, but you don't remember anything in between. Or you've sat down and you've had a meal. You remember starting it, you remember finishing it, but you don't remember the journey of flavors and textures and sensations and tastes in between. So this is something that we need to, as Buddhist practitioners, and have an opportunity and an invitation to really take a deep dive into, both on a level that I'm pointing to in terms of kind of mundane things like the drives cross town and the food that we eat, but in a more significant way on a deeper level. So I wanted to, just kind of articulate a little bit about the arc of my own journey. Where this really begins is by starting to take a look at ourselves, to cultivate awareness about not just what's going on outside, but what is going on inside. To pay attention to the types of thoughts we have, the types of emotions, the frequency of them, the content of them, the quality of them. And part of this is difficult because, one, it's not something that's necessarily fostered by or encouraged, or we don't get this training from our family of origin. It's not certainly something that's cultivated or terribly valued by a lot of our society. I'm assuming most of you are employed and have settings where people don't really want to know your thoughts or your heart so much as they want their end product, and as soon as possible, please. And so we find ourselves in these various containers where we spend a lot of time that are a little bit antithetical to this process of that Zen offers. And that for us coming to a place like this for retreat, or for those who live here, have more spaciousness and more of a consistent invitation to do what our founder of Soto Zen said is the essence of practice, which is to study the self. So there are distractions, which is one barrier, but perhaps more of a force, of a dynamic that impedes this process is our own reaction and feelings about the content of our hearts and our minds. If you sit down and just observe your mind, many things can happen. And when I say mind, I often forget to add on mind-heart, but I'm talking about this complete axis, shin. There's no separation, mind and heart. So when you sit down, you know, perhaps you'll be terribly bored. You'll get caught in a revolving door of endless thought. Round and round and round, and it doesn't feel like you're getting any type of traction whatsoever. So that's one experience that you can have. And at first, that's not very encouraging or satisfying. And another thing that can happen that I think does happen for many of us is that the content of our hearts and our minds is sometimes difficult. Either because of things that we see in ourselves, Arshu so self-confessed some of the thoughts he has about supporters of this current administration, for instance, thinks that as, you know, a person that has a certain value, system in life doesn't want to necessarily cop to the feelings of animosity or judgment or whatnot. So there are things that arise for us that can be kind of embarrassing or don't quite line up with our idea of who we think we are. And then on a deeper level, there is just all of that gunk and that junk that comes from having been a human, having been born into a human form, into a human family, into a particular karmic crucible of whatever it was your constellation of mom, dad, siblings, grandparents, uncles, whatever. And often there's a lot of what we currently call dysfunction in those settings, and which from a Buddhist perspective would of course just be called unskillful behavior or ignorance, right? But having been born into that particular crucible, man, oh man, are we ever influenced by it, right? You know, here I am at 66 still feeling some of those influences, some of those taints from having grown up in a very dysfunctional family with a particular type of father who was challenging, right? So turning toward our the content of our minds and our hearts can be unattractive, unappealing, and frightening to us. And yet, it is that very material which is going to be the Dharma gate to our true transformation of our suffering and to our true liberation. So for me, this process began, as it does, I think, for many people, which is that there just happened to be a co-arising in my life of enormous suffering, and very proximate to that was Buddhist practice. And starting to be exposed to the Dharma and be exposed to practitioners of the Dharma. And as Sharon Salzberg articulates so beautifully in her book, Faith, and a similar thing happened to her, and what she experienced and how she articulated what she saw happening amidst her suffering was being exposed to the Dharma was a bright type of faith, something sparkly. Something attractive was glimmering there that held a certain type of promise. She'd read a book, she'd come across a teacher, she'd been to a Sunday like this. And so that just kind of started the journey. I'm going to say, miraculous moments that happen for us. And I don't think that they were that frequent. But those are the moments that kind of start our waking up process. They're the beginning of an epiphany that sets us off on this path, on this journey to finding greater liberation. So that was my situation as well. I was in the midst of suffering and I was very proximate to the Dharma and teachers. And so I thought, yeah, I'll try this. I tried everything else. Right? Other strategies didn't work. And God knows in our society and in our endless creativity to find distractions as humans, there's never a shortage. We can binge watch on Prime, or we can, you know, Netflix, or we can eat, or we can work, you know, 23 hours of the day. There's just no shortage of things that we can do to turn away from this important content of heart and mind. But fortunately, I had that moment of grace, that clarity, that epiphany to stay with it. And then the next thing that happened to me was that I found a very, very good, in fact, my best spiritual friend, who turned out to be my teacher. And it was seeing in her that she had gone through this very process herself and that it worked. She had verified it for herself. I could see it embodied in her living. And that she had an incredible sense of stability and joy. And she offered to me, not exactly in these words, but to be my guide through this morass, what seemed like a morass, and to be a steady, stable friend. And the value of people like this in our lives is unimaginable, really hard to articulate. Somebody that you know has gone through this process, and they are truly walking their talk. They're not just talking it. And that what they promise and what they offer to you is to hold up a clear mirror that comes from a place of love, but is clear and is going to say to you, you know what, Cynthia? You're living a fear-based life. The way you are managing your fear through your uber competence is not only protecting you and cutting you off from people, but it's cutting you off from your genuine experience. Because you're up here constantly in a little tiny corner that you've painted yourself into in order to protect yourself in uber competence while the rest of your life is happening and you're not even paying attention to it. And over time, because this is not a fast process for a person like me and maybe for many people, over time, her presence helped me to relax, to trust, and to settle in and walk this path that does have some difficulties on it, that does have some shards of the glass of our past, of our experience, of our karma. So with this combination of something ineffable, in a crossing of my life and the suffering with the Buddhist path and with finding a good spiritual friend, I started to really take that backward step. And we hear this. This is bandied around in practice a lot. And it can kind of become banal because you hear it with some amount of frequency. But because it may sound banal, it should not be underestimated. What happens in my life, and I think what is very common in many people's lives, is that without the backward step and without examining what's going on here in this very important access of being, we just assume that all the unexamined contents and information that's sending out signals is true. In my case, oh yes, everybody's scary and not to be trusted. I have to take care of everything if I want it to get done. I have to take care of myself. Or whatever your story is, right? So without that backward step, which starts to introduce, just by virtue of taking a backward step, some space around what is the content of your heart and your mind, you can't start to actually begin to separate out that what you think and feel is not reality, it's just what you think and feel. And you cannot begin to see, oh, this is how my heart and my mind operate. This is not necessarily life or truth. This is how Cynthia's heart and mind operates because of the, you know, karmic experiences she's had. And maybe because of some biochemistry and other things like that. And without making that separation, we're just going to continue to live these lives, unexamined lives, where we're going to be doing nothing but hidden to ourselves, separated from ourselves, and everything will be concealed. And all of the pain, the fear, the suffering of our lives left unexamined is going to come out. It's going to come out as, for some of you perhaps, as it did in my case, as fear, self-loathing, constant self-criticism, minimization, just making myself and my life smaller and smaller in a false sense of trying to find security that way. But then there are also those moments where it just can't help but come forward with a certain force because it doesn't really want to be suppressed, and it comes out sideways sometimes with daggers, or maybe directly in very unskillful behavior. So this backward step is really important because it allows us to start to get some perspective. And then in that perspective and starting to separate out what has arisen as a result of our karma, what what has shaped our heart and our mind and how it functions, then we can start to see and feel that that's not really how we want to be. That is not our Buddha nature. That is not in alignment with our heart minds that want to wake up and express our bodhicitta. And in that space, we start to get the maneuverability to realize that we can make other choices. We can try other things. So the first thing that tends to happen out of this awareness, and I want to say that this awareness is really important. Thich Nhat Hanh just says it so simply in one of his books. He says, awareness is the beginning of healing. Without being aware of what's going on, we can't start a healing process to return to our full humanity, to our Buddha nature. So with this awareness and studying, and with the help of practice and Dharma and other wonderful containers, be they practice, be they therapy, whatever, we can start to gain the stability and the space to start systematically looking at some of this stuff and seeing how it manifests. And usually how it manifests in our lives is that it's causing us suffering, and quite often other people suffering out of our unskillful behavior. So if we are awakened to the point where we're touching our Buddha nature, or even just the promise that we might have Buddha nature, we're feeling some of our lives coming online, we're going to want to implement some changes, and we're going to realize in this process that we're not locked in to a fixed sense of self. I mean, the sense of non-duality and of no self is, you know, key to Buddhism and to the Dharma, that we have that opportunity, that ability to be much more fluid, and that nothing is fixed in this world of ours, nothing. And now we're trying to put a stake down and to say, this is my fixed self, is just, you know, spitting in the wind anyway, in addition to causing us suffering and pain. So we start to look at the contents of our heart and our mind. We identify that which causes suffering and unskillfulness and harm. And then we start to embody different behaviors, because Buddhism is, as much as we sit quietly, it's really a program of action. If we only sit, we're missing the point. It's about getting up off the cushion and taking the Dharma and applying it to ourselves and to our lives. So we look at what's going on and we start to say, you know, I don't want to be a fear-based person. I don't want to be a person who has sharp speech, that's always using her speech to falsely elevate herself and protect herself at the expense of people that are put down. I don't want to live in this small little space that I've painted myself into that's all about demonstrating competence, but is so lonely and isolated. So restraint of action is what we start first. And then we learn and are taught that interjecting intentionally beneficial and skillful actions and intentions into our being at the same time is very, very helpful, which is why we chant, which is why we chant the vows, which is why we why we practice things like loving kindness, because these are the antidotes to the habit energy that we have cultivated over many, many years that has caused us so much harm and unskillfulness. And so these vows, our intentions to want to cultivate a more wholesome life, to be kinder to ourselves, to offer loving kindness to ourselves and to others, work. This is technology that has been in existence for 2,500 years. And we must start with ourselves. If we do not learn how to transform our suffering, we will likely be of limited benefit to the rest of the world and have limited access to the rest of our lives. So we start to experience some shifts in our heart and our mind, in our behavior. I've told my Sangha this several times, but for those of you who for whom I am a fresh experience, I did a practice period on my brother-in-law, who I really was challenged by. He just worked every last nerve, and every desire I had in my body was something close to wanting to wring his neck or use extremely unskillful behavior toward him. And so my teacher suggested I do an independent practice period on him to study the type of suffering that arose and what he was touching in me, and why I was having so much difficulty with him, and to do this in earnest. And we did this for like about 3 months. And toward the end of this practice period, which I shared with no one except my teacher, my brother-in-law came up to me and he said, "I don't know what's going on with you, but you sure have changed." That was one of my first experiences from a pure Buddhist perspective, that this stuff really works. That's exactly the intended effect that I had, wanted to have with him. And meanwhile, internally, I was feeling all of those intense feelings were receding into the background because I was offering him loving kindness every day. And I was offering myself loving kindness because I had to live with such a brother-in-law. Both were equally true, right? The power of our intention is just astonishing. And this is a reason why we vow and vow and vow again. In all of our ceremonies, every single ceremony that we do on the full moon of every month, to be reminded that this is where we want to live. We want to live in this place of intention. Because Dido Laurie said in one of his book on precepts, when we intend something or when we vow, we set in motion the karma of that vow. So that's exactly what happened with my brother-in-law. I really wanted to have a different relationship with him. I did all the things. It didn't feel instantaneously like anything was happening or changing, but he gave me a lot of feedback at the end of that first practice period. I had to do several. that he was experiencing the change. You know, there are kind of several things that are going on here that are really important. Buddha talks about this as the unbinding of self. We're all bound up in all of these thoughts and ideas and unexamined, unhealed emotions and experiences. And that's how we're living our lives, and we're just completely bound, and it's just a feeling of imprisonment. It's so encouraging to read Dogen. You may not know that, but Dogen is very encouraging. And at one point in my favorite fascicle, he actually says, I too was like this. I was in a cave of my own imprisonment, and I was near the periphery of Buddhism. And that's lovely for me to think about, a person as accomplished and as incredible as Dogen was, our founder of Soto Zen, that's where he started too, in a cave, imprisoned, bound up by these same things that bind all of us. And he found his way out of it, right? Through this very same technology of practice. So there is this process that we go through, and in the process, it starts to loosen us up and it starts to unbind us. And that is one aspect of freedom, to be free from the bondage of all of this unexamined heart-mind content. And then the next freedom is that we actually cultivate some skillfulness and we start learning how to react and respond to life appropriately. And we go through this process. It is not a one-time event. For those of us who are committed to practice, it's going to be to the end of our lives. certainly for me, several lifetimes. I'm a slow learner. But I think what happens is that when we go through it the first time, and even as I said, with a simple example like my brother-in-law, I got feedback. This is working. I was encouraged. I started to have confidence that I could change a lot of these unexamined behaviors and habit energies that were always coming out sideways, that always were separating me from my life, from the present moment, from that ability to be radically present and at the same time to be radically present with a very deep and true sense of peace and ease and stability. And so the next type of freedom is that we realize we get to choose how we respond to life. Whatever the circumstances, wherever we put our foot, whatever breath we are breathing, because we are now have this some amount of insight into ourselves, some amount of clarity, and we have a familiarity with how the process works, and we've done it, we've stayed with ourselves under difficult experiences, going through difficult emotions, intrusive, scary emotions, boring, mundane emotions, and we've just stayed and we've stayed and we've stayed and we've watched how things can change just by staying there with our intention. And then a whole other world opens up because now we can start living dharmically out of our desire to be wholesome, wholehearted, skillful. We can make, or try to make, responses that are appropriate to the situation, whatever arises before us. And if we don't, if it's not successful, that's okay. Our intention was pure, and then we just go back and we, rectify it and try again, because it is practice. It's not perfection. And I love that this practice acknowledges how challenging it is to be a human, and how challenging this whole process of studying the self and transforming our suffering is. And Dogen talks about it as just being a mistake after a mistake after a mistake. But that's okay, because while we're making mistakes, we're still waking up. While we're making mistakes, we're still cultivating skillfulness. While we're in the midst of obstructions in certain areas, we're waking up in other areas. And at the end of the day, what I learned is to, what I started to experience was this sense of being able to be radically present with a fair amount of my life, to do so with peace and ease and stability, to know that this is not a one-time event, so to have confidence when things keep arising and other unexamined pieces of my own being come forward, or life just happens and difficulty presents itself, to have confidence that who knows on what timetable, but ultimately if I stay with it, my own suffering about it will be transformed. And all of that conjoins to allow us to truly get off the surface of our lives and to sink into what is really happening, to be really, really present for it. The whole trip across town, the whole meal. And for me, that then becomes very, very simply, but so importantly, authentic living. I'm no longer living out of my fears. I'm no longer living out of my ideas about how I think life should be or how I think Cynthia should be. I have a kind of a new armory of experiences and trainings and teachings that are going to support me and be with me under all circumstances to allow me to have what I really want, which is that sense of peace and ease and stability as I go through this very dynamic vital and sometimes beautiful, sometimes challenging experience called my life. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.